This is number 0013, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. It is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, and we have a full show coming your way on this program number 0013. You'll get a chance to hear from Chris Epting, author of Roadside Baseball, and you might want to go lake diving to find Babe Ruth's piano.
About 16 miles outside of Boston, when the Babe was a rookie with the Red Sox, bought a farmhouse out there in Sudbury. The farmhouse is still there. Across the street, there's a place called Willis Pond, which is a big lake. And supposedly, one night in their drunken revelry, the Babe and his buddies push a piano out on the frozen lake there, Willis Pond. And Babe plays for them, and there's all kinds of craziness out there. They leave the piano out there when they go back inside in the winter. And come spring thaw, obviously the ice goes away, and the piano sinks to the bottom of the lake. And today there are great Ruth scholars and archaeologists who go out there with sonar gear to try and locate the infamous Babe Ruth piano.
John Thompson runs a website called restroomratings.com. Just how do you rate a public washroom?
There's definitely not a scientific process to it. I think anyone who spends some time on the site will find out more about the experience of the restroom than necessarily the amount of fixtures or even the cleanliness. Because sometimes I know a lot of people rate cleanliness as the number one thing, but I think a lot of times it's the ambience and the experience that really sets a restroom apart.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman with a review of Mackenzie Phillips' controversial memoir, High on Arrival, and another Mamas and the Papas related book that you should read if you want to know what it was like to be California dreamin'. That's what's coming up on Book Banter.
We'll hear from Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation.
I'm angry tonight. I'm angry tonight. Hi, this is Steve Walsh. You know, your guy in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. You're going to want to stick around for my two-minute tirade. It's coming up later on, right here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And, of course, we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, including an idiot of the day. The guest Slater on this edition of the Stuff File program, the person that told you it was number 0013, is Natasha Vincent, the education co-director of SBI eLearning, a live online business training program for entrepreneurs. That's SBI eLearning. E-business success. Simple. Real. Okay, let's get to the Stuff File, shall we? We start off with a story in London, England. A British man on the run from police sent a picture of himself to his local newspaper because he disliked the mugshot they had printed of him as part of a public appeal to track him down. South Wales police had issued media with a photo of Matthew Maynard, wanted by officers investigating a house burglary as part of a crackdown on crime in Swansea. When it appeared in the South Wales edition of the Evening Post, the 23-year-old sent the newspaper a replacement photo of himself standing in front of a police van. They obligingly printed it on the front page. The police thanked him for helping them in their appeal, saying, "Everyone in Swansea will know what he looks like now." It's amazing how some people will help in solving crime, even if they are the criminal. We have a similar story like that coming up right now, which comes from Wisconsin. The call came into the 911 dispatcher. "I don't want to hurt anybody. I'm drunk." And with that, Mary Stray, age 49, of Granton, reported herself as a drunken driver about 3 miles northeast of Neillsville in central Wisconsin. Clark County Sheriff's Chief Deputy Jim Backus said that Stray's call on October 24th led deputies to cite her for misdemeanor drunken driving with a blood alcohol level double the legal limit to drive. She makes her first court appearance on December 10th. Backus said drunken drivers reporting themselves are rare. As I keep saying, I couldn't make these stories up if I tried. So listen for yourself. Here is the actual 911 call. I didn't do anything to it except add a little theme music, you know, just to enhance it. Enjoy.
911.
Somebody's really drunk driving down Granton Road.
Which way are they going?
They are going,
towards Granton or towards Neillsville?
Towards Granton.
Okay, are you behind them, or?
No, I am them.
You am them?
Yes, I am them.
Okay, so you want to call and report that you're driving drunk?
Yes.
Okay, what's your name?
Mary.
Okay, hold on 1 second, Mary, okay?
Okay.
Are you still driving right now?
Yes.
Do you want to stop driving before you get in an accident?
Yes, I will stop.
Okay, you going to stop right now?
Okay, I'm stopping.
Okay, just hang on the phone, okay? What's your last name, Mary?
Sorry.
Are you stopped right now?
Yes, I am.
What kind of vehicle do you have, Mary?
I have a Saturn. Can I take my seatbelt off?
If you're stopped.
If I'm stopped.
If you're stopped, that's fine, yeah.
I'm in park.
Okay.
Can I take my seatbelt off?
Yeah, as long as you're not driving, as long as you're not moving.
Should I turn my car off and turn the flashers on?
Yep, that's fine. If you want to turn it off and turn the flashers on, so then we can find you. Okay, just hold on 1 second again, Mary, okay?
Okay.
Isn't that fun? I love that line, I am them, and the dispatcher says, you are them. It's a wonder 911 operators can keep a straight face sometimes. Moving right along, we go to another woman who has some driving issues. This one in Tampa, Florida. The driver and the child in her lap survived when a pickup truck slammed into a 1,500-gallon aquarium at Tampa International Airport. The tropical fish were not so lucky. Airport officials said 36-year-old Yamil Campuzano Martin lost control of her truck and drove into the saltwater tank outside the American Airlines baggage claim. An airport spokesperson said the driver had an unrestrained 6-year-old boy in her lap. About 90% of the 30 to 40 saltwater fish in the tank were killed. The aquarium was part of a public art program. The airport spent $200,000 on the exhibit, which included the 12-foot tank. Yamil was cited for careless driving. Meanwhile, let's talk about the demise of another animal, shall we? When Canada's transport minister decided to name his cat Thatcher, he likely never thought it would cause quite the stir it did during a gala dinner last week. During a tribute to Canada's military in Toronto, some 1,700 luminaries, including Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, were in the middle of a dinner on Tuesday night when smartphones throughout the room began to buzz with the news Lady Thatcher had passed away. Dinner chatter abruptly veered to expressions of shock and reminiscences of Margaret Thatcher, the 84-year-old former British Prime Minister, as news of her apparent passing spread like wildfire. Harper's aide, Dimitri Soudas, back in Ottawa, was dispatched to confirm the news and start preparing an official statement. Soudas immediately emailed his contacts at Buckingham Palace and in British Prime Minister Gordon Brown's office. They had no idea what he was talking about. Lady Thatcher, they informed and embarrassed Soudas, was still very much alive. About 20 minutes after the rumor mill started churning, a corrective email message began to circulate among the diners at the hall. Turns out it was Transport Minister John Baird's beloved 16-year-old cat, who he'd named Thatcher out of the admiration of one of his political heroes. It was the cat who had ceased to be. Meanwhile, Soudas is said to have quipped since, if the cat wasn't dead, I'd have killed it by now. Well, you might still have your chance, pal. It should have 8 more lives. Anyway, moving right along, let's get to our first guest. So here we are in November, and the baseball season has finally come to an end. But for fans who really miss baseball, even though it's only been a little while, they can still get their fix. To tide them over until spring training, Chris Epting, author of Roadside Baseball, which is published by Santa Monica Press, recommends fans hit up the sport's quirkiest landmarks. And he's on the line with us right now. Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm good, Peter. How you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us once again.
My pleasure.
So,
anytime.
First of all, are you happy with the outcome, New York versus Philadelphia?
Well, I'm an Angels fan, so, you know, I'm glad the American League won. I thought it was a good series. Like a lot of people, I was hoping for a game seven. I'm just sort of bummed that they're playing the first week of November now, and I wonder at what point is it going to stretch into December and become a 12-month sport. I mean, it's really getting out of control here. But I thought it was a good series. I think there were some great performances. And, you know, I love baseball, so I never feel too bad about it. But that said, I do wish it was the Angels playing the Phillies in there.
Well, I'm reminded of the title of that very excellent Broadway play, Damn Yankees.
Yeah.
So you know how I feel.
I know, but you know what's really strange I felt this year? Here they are christening their new Yankee Stadium, and it never looked full, and it didn't feel as crazy as the old Yankee Stadium.
Yeah, you're right.
And I thought it was a real statement that next door you had the darkened place, you know, where all those other previous 26 championships had been won. And at Yankee Stadium, they couldn't fill up the seats behind home plate, or if they were, people were downstairs eating caviar. And I thought that that was sort of an interesting, you know, yes, they won at their new ballpark, but I'm not sure it looked, as a TV event, I don't think it was nearly as energetic or electric as the old Yankee Stadium looked. I really don't.
You got a point. Maybe the fans were too cold, though, anyway, because it is November. But let's get to your book. There's so many things to talk about for, as I said, baseball fans out there who are looking for a baseball fix now that the season is over. So tell us about some of the things they can find in Roadside Baseball.
Well, you know, it depends what neck of the woods you live in. The country covers all, I mean, the book covers all of North America. And obviously, if you're back east, there are a ton of Yankee and Red Sox sites all throughout New England and stuff. There are a ton of sites in California. But the Midwest has a lot of great ones, too. I was just in Louisville, Kentucky at the Louisville Slugger Hall of Fame. That's a great spot in the off season to go in and watch the bats still getting made in preparation for spring and to get a photo out in front of the world's tallest bat, which is like 150 feet tall. I love that place if you're, you know, ever down south. I always think the resting place of Babe Ruth in Valhalla, New York is an important spot to kind of go pay your respects at. And recently I was at the former site of Shea Stadium where I grew up going to games. It's in the parking lot now, but they've marked where the bases were with a series of brass plaques. So that's kind of interesting, too, given that the old Yankee Stadium still stands and both parks were closed at the same time. Shea they couldn't get rid of fast enough. Yankee they're surgically removing brick by brick. So,
well, you mentioned the final resting spot of Babe Ruth. And speaking of Babe Ruth and final resting spots, what's the story from Sudbury, Massachusetts?
Another great spot to visit, about 16 miles outside of Boston. When the Babe was a rookie with the Red Sox, bought a farmhouse out there in Sudbury. The farmhouse is still there. Across the street, there's a place called Willis Pond, which is a big lake. And supposedly, one night in their drunken revelry, the Babe and his buddies push a piano out on the frozen lake there, Willis Pond. And Babe plays for them, and there's all kinds of craziness out there. They leave the piano out there when they go back inside in the winter. And come spring thaw, obviously the ice goes away, and the piano sinks to the bottom of the lake. And today there are great Ruth scholars and archaeologists who go out there with sonar gear to try and locate the infamous Babe Ruth piano. And I think it's just one of the great, it's sort of, I call it like the Loch Ness Monster of baseball, because they're down there underwater with the sonar trying to find it. And if they could ever dredge it up, it would make, I think, a spectacular Hall of Fame exhibit someday. And it is more evidence of the insanity of Babe Ruth, is whatever he touched automatically became like Holy Grail stuff, you know. And I think that's a fun thread in the book as well, is to follow, you know, Babe Ruth all over the country, whether it's Dunsmuir, California, or you mentioned Sudbury, all the places he visited, which are very well marked today. Even there's a place in Hawaii where he planted a tree, and the tree is still there with his name on a plaque on the tree. So that you could do just a book of Babe Ruth landmarks, I'm convinced, like Roadside Ruth, you know, and it would be fun.
There seem to be so many characters in the earlier days of baseball. Are the characters of the sport gone, or with the exception of left-handed pitchers, or is it a situation that they became characters because there was a camaraderie amongst the players and also a privacy issue that they had? They weren't being followed by the press and the paparazzi like they are today.
I think that what you just said is what tapped into it. You have to remember, back in the days when teams traveled by train, the press traveled with them. And so the press had their back on a lot of levels, but the press would play cards with them. They were really friends of these guys. And I think a lot of the character stuff came out of the quirks that the press got to see day in, day out. Again, they were living together in a lot of respects, the press and the players. And so the press understood that they had to look after these guys and, you know, sort of look the other way on things. But it was the press that would coin all of those great nicknames, you know, Dizzy and Daffy Dean. That was a process of the press. And I think that was a way they could create fun people to write about, you know, fun characters. So I think once the separation came in with the press and players traveled in luxury jets and, you know, I think a lot of that broke down that system where players would get sort of, you know, characterized like that. And you have almost none of that today. And I think it's a really sad fact. I think it was a great part of the game, and there's really no reason for it to ever grow back. I mean, players are so isolated today. I think Yogi Berra said at the beginning of this year, what spooked him most about the new Yankee Stadium was how big the clubhouse was. He said, guys don't sit by each other anymore. Nobody talks to each other. Nobody plays cards. Everybody sits there on computers and cell phones. And so it's continuing. You know, it moved away from the press being close. Now the players themselves are growing apart from each other, and they're becoming more isolated and more bubbles. So I think you're losing a lot of the quirky character stuff that used to exist.
The only people apparently who are giving out nicknames anymore is Chris Berman on ESPN. He's about the only one.
That's become his shtick. But again, and you've got far fewer baseball beat writers, you know, because newspapers have taken such a hit. So that aspect of baseball, I think, is just sort of lost in the mist now. It's one of those things that, you know, it's part of history, unfortunately. And to me, it really separated baseball because, again, those great nicknames and characters, there was no other sport that had that. And again, the players now travel on such a different level than everybody else.
Your book,
that, you know, kids. Pardon?
Your book, Roadside Baseball, is it set out in such a way that you can travel from point A to B? Can you literally crisscross the United States following your book like a map?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, again, it's broken down, I think, very easily. There are small maps. It's done state by state, you know, by region. And I think it's very simple. You know, depending on what your selfish interests are, if you follow a certain player or team, there are ways to do it. For instance, if you love Jackie Robinson, there's a whole series of a tour you can do about him. But I think the fun is wandering. Look, it's become a thing today for people to go around the country and say, I'm going to go to 10 ballparks in 12 days. You know, it's like the old Frommer's Europe thing, and people do that with baseball today. So my attitude is, for those couple of hours you might have of downtime in Cleveland before you go to the ballpark, why not go to the former site of League Park, where the diamond still exists? Why not go see the grave of Ray Chapman, the only man killed by a pitched ball? There are places all over North America that really speak to the history of the game. And if you take a little time, they may even be in your own backyard. It may not require any travel. I learned recently, I live in Southern California, the guy who wrote Take Me Out to the Ball Game is buried 10 minutes from my house. I mean, you know, so there's things like that that I think are also surprising in the book of what you might be close to without even knowing it.
Doesn't it say something to the sport of baseball, too, that there's a little bit of baseball history in virtually every corner of North America?
Totally. I mean, that's what makes it different. It's why baseball fans, the number 714 means something, you know. It's why we argue about 154 versus 162. I mean, baseball has a way of just infecting our brain with things, with stats and figures and stories, and I think that's why it spread. You didn't just have Major League Baseball either. You had the Pacific Coast League and various other independent leagues that helped the game take root in other communities. But you know what? It's the most basic sport in the world, throwing a ball, hitting it with a stick. You know what I mean? And I think that's why so many people in North America feel a kinship to it, whether they played it or not. Their fathers might have played it, or their grandfathers or their grandmothers. And it's a very generational game with a lot of emotion tied into it.
The book is called Roadside Baseball. It's published by Santa Monica Press. It's written by Chris Epting, and you can check out Chris's website, which is www.chrisepting.com. You could also go to my website, peteranthonyholder.com, click on the Stuff File program page, and you'll find links to Chris's website and also links to amazon.com and amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. I thank you very much, Chris, for taking the time to be on the program with us once again.
Peter, anytime. Thank you very much. I look forward to talking to you again.
Chris Epting, author of Roadside Baseball. You can find links to Chris's website by going to my website, peteranthonyholder.com, clicking on the What's On page, and you'll find links that will take you there. Also links to amazon.com and amazon.ca, where you can order Chris's book, that is Roadside Baseball, right there from the website. This is the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, now also heard on CyberStationUSA.com.
What are they saying about if the rains don't cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Abidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. If you're listening to this while walking with your iPod, make sure you look both ways before you cross the street. It's safety first on the Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the Stuff File program, we'll check restrooms. We'll also have book banter with Stuart Nullman. Steve Walsh will be along with our man in the heart of America checking the pulse of the nation. And of course, we have an idiot of the day. And lots more stuff, including stuff right here, right now. We go to Australia for our next story. It was just a routine car wash, except there was no car and no clothing. Four Australian men who allegedly undressed and soaped up at a car wash have been charged with exposure and public nuisance. Police said the men paid for a car wash before stripping nude and cleaning themselves in the soapy water while their female companions took photos. Police arrived mid-cycle after being called by smart wash operators in the town of Biloela in Queensland State. The four men are due to appear in court next month. Police and the car wash operator warned the public against mimicking the men, with police saying the high-pressure washer could be dangerous, especially if it goes in the eyes. Hey, I'm just worried about the hot wax and that buffer, although some people out there might really enjoy that buffer. It depends. Moving right along, Colton Harris Moore, age 18, is suspected in around 50 burglaries around the Seattle, Washington metropolitan area in the last 18 months. He's also a fugitive after escaping from a halfway house after one of his many convictions. Now, whenever a burglary victim or the police spot him, Harris Moore, who is typically barefoot, runs into the woods and disappears. He grew up in the woods and apparently knows how to hide in them. Police are especially worried about a new crime trend, which they think is being committed by Harris Moore: airplane theft. Several small planes have been taken in recent months from hangars where investigators have found bare footprints, and all of the planes were found crash-landed. His mother, Pam Kohler, doesn't find much wrong with her boy's activities. In fact, considering he doesn't know how to fly a plane, he's doing pretty well, she says. I hope to hell he stole those airplanes, she told a reporter. I would be so proud. But put in there that I want him to wear a parachute next time. There's a mother of the year for you, huh? Locals seem to think the hoodlum is some sort of folk hero for avoiding capture, but police say they don't have the manpower to hunt him over a large area for simple property crimes. Well, let's see what they all say when an empty plane crashes in a fireball into a school while a barefooted felon hanging from a parachute watches. I bet they'll have a different tune to sing at that point. Okay, moving right along, Brenda and Robert Vail, architects who specialize at sustainability, are professors at the Victoria University in Wellington, New Zealand. The title of their new book summarizes their latest thesis, Time to Eat the Dog, The Real Guide to Sustainable Living. The Vails argue that a Toyota Land Cruiser and a medium-sized dog have approximately equal footprints on the planet's ecology. A typical cat, they say, has an eco-footprint equivalent to a Volkswagen Golf automobile. Once you see where cats and dogs fit into your overall balance of things, Mr. Vail said, you might decide to have the cat, but not also have the two cars and the three bathrooms. Hey, back off, pal. One of those bathrooms might be for the dog. Just saying. Our next story comes from Erie County, New York. A sheriff's deputy stopped a vehicle for speeding at 1:50 a.m. But by the time he got to the vehicle to talk to the driver's seat was empty. The only occupant of the car was sitting in the back seat and insisted he had not been driving. Since no one had left the vehicle, officers arrested Michael G. Spagnola, age 38, on suspicion of drunk driving. His blood alcohol level was measured at 0.12. It's uncanny how the cops were able to see through such unbelievable explanations. He just hopped into the back seat and thought the cops would buy that story, saying he didn't do it? You think this guy would be a candidate for Idiot of the Day later in the show? But no, there's a better one, but that's coming up later. Right now, however, our next guest is on the line. A man in Minneapolis has one crappy hobby. He rates public bathrooms. John Thompson runs RestroomRatings.com, a database of public restroom reviews submitted from around the world. Hi, John. Thanks for being on the program with us.
Hi, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here.
You have been doing this for how long now?
We started in 2001, so I guess that puts it at 8 years now.
Now, there are some of us who just won't go into public washrooms if we don't have to, and here you are going in them and rating them. How and why did this get started?
It started with a simple conversation. You know, I think everyone probably has had that conversation where they walk out of a restroom and they wish they had never gone in there. They wish there was some kind of rating system or you know, sometimes it's just the story that comes out of a restroom, something interesting, something they saw. And everyone always talks about it. So I'm like, well, I'm a web developer. Why don't we find a good way to showcase these stories?
So I understand you yourself have inspected about 400 bathrooms yourself. Now, I mentioned in the intro that you're from Minneapolis. Are they within the Minneapolis area, or have you traveled extensively?
I think about half of them are in the Minneapolis area. When I travel somewhere, I try to snap a couple photos, but I'm not always the best at that. So I know I have a couple from Japan that I took, and Spain, and Costa Rica, South America. I think I might have got an Argentina one, maybe, in Chile.
Well, since you're from Minneapolis, I have to ask this question. Do you have, or have you rated, the Larry Craig bathroom?
I had a feeling that might come up. I think I did a long time ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago. I think it might be worth checking in again because I know it became a popular tourist destination after last year or whenever that happened. But yeah, that's worth a revisit.
So what exactly is your rating system like? What do you rate it and how do you do it?
Well, there's definitely not a scientific process to it. I think anyone who spends some time on the site, they'll find out it's more about the experience of the restroom than necessarily the amount of fixtures or even the cleanliness. Because sometimes I know a lot of people rate cleanliness as the number one thing, but I think a lot of times it's the ambience and the experience that really really sets a restroom apart. So, it's kind of a gut feeling when you come out and you say, well, that was about a 7. So there's a lot of guesstimation in there.
Okay, so you're rating them, I would assume, on a scale of 1 to 10, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so on the high end of the scale, what are some of the best rated washrooms on your site, and why?
Sure. So I think cleanliness and the touchless experience is always a very key thing. Being able to walk in without having to touch anything, soap, water, paper dispenser, all being motion activated is nice. But I think there's a tendency when you get things like that involved, it becomes too sterile and it becomes a very maybe not a gratifying experience. So I think what I tend to rank higher than are these little personal touches that really set the restrooms apart. So, maybe the lighting has a bit of some gels, some colors that make it more interesting. Maybe there's a soundscape. I've been places where there's waves crashing in the background and maybe it's just the idea of putting a newspaper front page in front of the urinal so you can read while you're going. I think little things like that go a long way in making the restroom more memorable.
And on the other end of the scale, give us an example of something that rated very low. Has anything rated a 0, and if so, why?
I don't I don't know if the scale goes to zero. It probably should. And it probably actually should have some negative rankings in there. But, you know, one, obviously, if there's any visible fecal material or messes on the floor, obviously that's going to bring it down to a one. I think overflowing waste bins, it's something that can happen pretty easily, but I think it can go a long way in ruining the reputation of a restroom. So I keep an eye on that. Broken things, broken fixtures, leaks, things like that will bring you down.
Do you by any chance rate porta potties?
Oh, yes. And that's a little tough because I don't know if I've clearly defined the rules. The only rule I have is it has to be a public restroom. But I know porta potties spring up overnight and they'll be gone and whatever. So, you know, I'll accept porta potty reviews. And some of the more interesting ones we've got have been at public campsites and things like that where they're permanent structures, but, you know, they have a bird nesting in them or there's some really interesting thing going on with the porta potty.
Now, I was a theater usher in my teenage years, so I've had experience in cleaning out some washrooms, and it's been my experience that, surprise, surprise, it's actually the women's washrooms that were more dirty than the men's washrooms, but it was the women's washrooms that were more opulent. So having said that, is there a distinction in your ratings between the men's room and the ladies' room?
That's a good question. I don't want to get into a battle of the sexes thing. I honestly, I don't get into too many women's restrooms, so it's hard for me to judge. And like I said, since we don't have a scientific scale, it's also hard for me to compare notes with a female companion who happens to check out the women's restroom. So that said, I know men may tend to have more fun when they make a mess, and especially if there's alcohol involved. So, yeah, I guess I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Since you have, I would assume, with the website, which is restroomratings.com, you've got this database. It's not all just washrooms that you've been in, but rather people are sending in reviews from around the world. Is that correct?
Right, that's correct. So, anyone can go over there and click on submit a rating and submit their own.
So do you have a dearth of one gender's restrooms? Are there enough women's restrooms rated on your site? Or are you looking for more? I'll put the word out right now in case you are.
I'm absolutely looking for more. The problem is I think a lot of the ratings I get are they don't have a photo and then they'll just be a one-line description. And we're looking for something a little bit more substance behind the review. So we're looking for a paragraph or so and explaining, you know, what you saw, not just these restrooms were filthy, which is the bulk of the submissions we get are written like that.
Well, I was about to say part of the problem, I guess, is if you're not going into a restroom with the idea of rating it, you don't think about a rating unless you're not satisfied with the accommodations.
Exactly, yeah. And then later on they'll come home and say, well, I'm going to complain about this place I went to, and that's all they can do. So.
So where do you see this site going? How big can it grow? Do you see a book coming out of this? Have you heard, for instance, from any of the places that are rated who are either happy or not happy with the rating they may have received on your site?
I did hear from one particular museum that I had ranked very low because it had smelled of urine. And obviously, if you're going to be Googling a museum and the first thing that comes up is the smell of urine, they're not too happy with that. So they called and tried to get me to re-rate it, and I tried to explain them that the submission process is anyone can rate the restroom. If someone else submits a new rating and me as the editor, if I deem that appropriate, I can replace my own rating. So we try to act pretty democratically in that sense.
Okay, so basically what you're looking for, and again, the website is restroomratings.com. You're looking for someone to rate restrooms, public washrooms, anywhere around the world, and you want some substance as far as the rating is concerned and a picture if you can get one, right?
Right, exactly.
And they go to the website and submit it? How does that work?
Yep, there's just, I think it says submit a rating. You could click on that and you can put your city and your facility name and all that, and it could be a pretty quick process.
Excellent. Again, the website is restroomratings.com. John, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Thanks a lot, Peter.
John Thompson, who runs RestroomRatings.com, a database of public restroom reviews submitted from around the world. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, now also heard on CyberStationUSA.com.
This is the Stuff File. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nallman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And once again, we do indeed have Stuart Nallman with another edition of Book Banter. Hello, sir.
Hi, Peter.
How you doing?
Pretty good. The books are piling up. You gotta help me.
They tend to do that.
Well, especially this time of year.
Yes, that's true.
Well, and
the fall is the busiest time, right?
Oh, it certainly is. It's leading up to the peak Christmas buying season. So
absolutely.
Books do make great gifts.
Okay, so what do you got for us this week?
Well, on this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look at Mackenzie Phillips' controversial memoir, High on Arrival.
Uh-oh.
Yes, while reading this book, I came to the conclusion, after I finished it, that Mackenzie Phillips is very lucky that she survived to tell her story. I mean, this is a brutally frank account of a show business childhood that started so right and just went terribly wrong. But however, the vice that put Mackenzie Phillips through a dizzying roller coaster ride throughout her 50 years and brought her to the brink of professional and personal ruination was drugs, in particular cocaine and heroin, because it was not an uncommon occurrence for Mackenzie to snort cocaine or shoot up heroin in copious amounts even prior to a personal appearance. Mackenzie's very remorseful and regretful about how she nearly ruined her life thanks to a hardcore drug addiction, but she lays the responsibility of how she got started on such a destructive habit on her famous dad, Papa John Phillips, because she was brought up in an atmosphere of, you know, like a hippie, do what you want to do kind of thing in parallel with the rest of the mamas and the papas. In fact, Papa John encouraged this type of lifestyle, but Mackenzie realized that John's failings as a father, whom she believed should have been more of a protector, than a drug enabler and a neglectful father. But we all remember Mackenzie Phillips first in 1973 as the precocious teenager when she wrote with Paul LaMatte in 1973's American Graffiti, and then she went to great fame as the rebellious Julie Cooper on the CBS sitcom One Day at a Time. And that brought her a lot of fame and fortune, but without the proper direction, she managed to let the success and the showbiz excess draw her down into a powerful spiral which her rampant drug abuse helped to derail everything that she worked for. But it's both uplifting and heartbreaking to see points in her life that Mackenzie's about to emerge from her demons, only to shortly have the lure of illicit drugs pull her back down again. But she credits her luck and survival throughout this living heaven and hell to the enduring support of her family, particularly her mother, her brother Jeffrey, and her step-siblings China, Bijou, and Tam, her ex-husband Mick, and especially her son Shane, not to mention the tough love she received from her One Day at a Time co-stars Bonnie Franklin and Valerie Bertinelli. In short, the incest with John Phillips may have helped get the book a lot of headlines, but it's the story of Mackenzie Phillips' near-fatal drug addiction that makes High on Arrival such a powerful book to read. It's a story of a life in show business seen at the end of a syringe needle, and through triumphs, tragedies, recovery, relapse, and back to recovery again, Mackenzie Phillips can be satisfied with herself and live the rest of her life in peace, one day at a time. It's called High on Arrival by Mackenzie Phillips, published by Simon Spotlight Entertainment, and it's $29.99.
Now, there's some question. There are people who are talking saying, is the story involving her and her father true? I have no reason to doubt it.
Yeah.
But having read the book,
yeah.
What do you think?
I think it's true. I mean, if you want to get a better complimentary picture of her life with, you know, her father and also with the mamas and the papas, you should read John Phillips' memoir, Papa John, which was published in 1986 by Doubleday, and it complements the book very well, actually. I mean, the drug use is mentioned in Papa John. It's also mentioned, you know, he mentions his relationship with Mackenzie, not the illicit stuff.
Right.
But they were very close, actually. And although the book is out of print right now, and it's also was published in paperback by Dell, go find it because it's a very frank book and also great insights about what it was like to be a member of the Mamas and the Papas. But it's sort of one book goes hand in hand with the other, actually.
Mm. So I guess Mackenzie Phillips now will start a support group with Drew Barrymore.
I mean, Drew wasn't so as hardcore as Mackenzie, but
you may never know. But it's an interesting point because, I mean, here are two kids, literally two kids, who came out from the other side or the dark side to be somewhat successful and normal later in life when so many of their peers we didn't hear about because they just died.
Yeah, exactly.
Or are on Skid Row or whatever the case may be.
Oh, exactly. I mean, this is a very uplifting story, but like I said before, I'm glad she survived to tell this tale, and very lucky, too.
Excellent. Anything else for us?
Well, that's it for now. But like I said, do get Papa John. Also, I got the book autographed by John Phillips. I got to meet him, actually, in 1987. He was doing a coffee house appearance here in Montreal, and he was selling the book and got autographed. And it is a collector's item. He is a rock legend.
And one of the things you do have a lot of are collector's items.
Oh, I certainly do.
Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter. This is the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
You're listening to The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder. Facebook users, don't forget to join the Stuff File group. There's more Stuff File to come. From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, Peter Anthony Holder once again brings you Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. Lock up your daughters, and in West Virginia, your sheep. Joining Peter Anthony Holder is our intrepid embedded reporter, deep in the heartland of the U.S. of A., Stephen S. Walsh.
How you doing, Steve Areno?
I think I'm okay. I'll survive.
You think you're okay? What's wrong?
Well, the Yankees won the World Series.
Oh yeah, I hear you. I'm with you.
Oh, I'm peeved about that and all sorts of things. But let's get into that later.
Okay.
Okay, is that okay with you?
Fine with me.
Cool.
What do you
so
got?
You want to start this week?
Yeah. What do you got for us?
Oh, let's see. Okay, ready? Here we go. Dateline, Proctor, Minnesota.
That'd be the Gopher State.
Or land of 10,000 lakes.
Yes.
A Minnesota man has pleaded guilty to driving his motorized Lazy Boy chair while drunk. He was drunk, not the Lazy Boy chair.
I gotcha.
Yeah, a criminal complaint says 62-year-old Dennis Leroy Anderson. Only three names, right?
Yeah. Well, hey,
like
what's
Peter Anthony Holder? What, you know,
what's wrong with three names? What's wrong with three names?
As your reporter, Stephen Sean Walsh, would report.
Yes.
Yes. So Dennis Leroy Anderson told police he left a bar in the northern Minnesota town of Proctor on his chair after drinking eight or nine beers. Prosecutors say Anderson's blood alcohol content was 0.29. Now, that's more than three times the legal limit.
Wow.
When he crashed into a parked vehicle. This was back in August of 2008. He wasn't seriously hurt. Police said the chair was powered by a converted lawnmower and had a stereo and cup holders. The judge in this case gave him 180 days of jail time, but stayed the sentence and ordered 2 years of probation for the guy. Yep. So it's kind of nice. Just stay off the motorized lawn cutting accessory, okay? Just stay off. Stay off.
I thought maybe they'd let him keep the motorized Lazy Boy, but remove the cup holders.
Yeah, it seems to be it's the cup holders that got into trouble, huh?
Exactly, exactly.
Oh, boy, where do we go from here? Dateline, Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh, no, Ohio, I can hardly wait to say goodbye, oh.
There's that music.
I know. I used to live there.
It's the Buckeye State, by the way.
It is the Buckeye State. Yeah, I lived there for the year of my life. I'll never get back.
You keep reminding us.
Not in Cleveland, but in OH-10.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway, transit police in Cleveland say a man waiting for a bus was attacked by four men who took money and his chicken dinner.
Ugh.
Yeah, I know. That's the worst part of it. Greater Cleveland Regional Transit Authority police say the 64-year-old victim was treated for minor injuries following the incident on the city's east side. And I've been to the city's east side. Scary. Investigators are asking for tips that will lead them to suspects. The man had just bought the chicken and was waiting for a bus to take him home for dinner. Police said his assailants made off with the food and $17. The 17 bucks, not a problem. The dinner? Hey, come on. Now we're talking serious stuff here, okay?
There is a why did the chicken cross the road joke here somewhere, but we haven't got time for it.
I know why he crossed the road, because he wanted to see his friend Gregory Peck. That was an old chicken joke from years gone by.
Oh, man.
Dateline, Council Bluffs, Iowa.
That'll be the Hawkeye State.
Yeah, I never lived there.
Not yet.
Now, a woman surprised by a man in the front room of her home near Council Bluffs grabbed a plastic toy bat and hit the guy repeatedly until he ran out the front door. The Pottawatomie County Sheriff's Office said the 26-year-old woman was taking a bath with her 3-year-old child when she noticed a cat, who normally stays outside, had entered the bathroom. Thinking this was rather odd, she said to herself, "My, I think this is odd." Anyway, she dressed and walked into the front room where she saw a man standing over her 4-year-old son, who was sleeping in a recliner. She yelled at him to leave, the guy, not the son, and threatened to call 911. But he hit her in the head. So she then grabbed the bat and hit this guy multiple times until he ran away. Oh, I love that. You know, this. You know the old saying, the old joke, of course, this premise is protected by Smith and Wesson?
Yes.
In her case, this premise is protected by Hillary and Bradsby.
Or Fisher-Price.
That too, yes. Why don't you want to be a Toys R Us kid? Dateline, Carroll, Iowa.
Still a Hawkeye state.
Still a Hawkeye state, yeah. Well, police had no trouble identifying two men accused of trying to break into a Carroll apartment. Police were responding to a call about an attempted burglary when they pulled over a car matching the alleged suspect's vehicle. Inside the car, officers found two men with their faces blackened with permanent marker. Police said the caller described two men with painted faces attempting to break into an apartment before driving off. They were easily found.
Any one of them singing Mammy?
Apparently one of them thought it was... apparently his name was Al. Mammy! Mammy! Well, I'm telling you, it was frightening.
And by the way, Steve, I forgot to mention earlier, do you know that people are now listening to you on CyberStationUSA.com?
Yes, you did mention that. Isn't that great to hear?
Thought I tossed that in there.
I know, that is good, because your show is worth listening to, and me being a part of this makes it even more fun to listen to.
There you go.
And I'm in the great state of Missouri for all you folks out there in the USA.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the wonderful state of Missouri.
Yep.
Which is right smack dab in the middle of the country.
Okay,
there we go. Let's see, where are we going from here, Peter? Oh, I got it. Dateline, Wisconsin. Somewhere in Wisconsin.
Okay, that's the Badger State.
The Badger State, or as we like to call it...
The Cheese State.
Where the motto is...
If it's cheddar...
It's better. A man who was shackled and being taken to the hospital by a police officer managed to escape by ditching his shackled pants and fleeing the scene. Actually, this wasn't too far from Madison, which is the capital. Anyway, while driving to the hospital, the officer pulled over to the side of the freeway and the suspect got out of the car. A struggle ensued between the officer and the guy before the prisoner... ran across the freeway and fled the scene without his pants. I love when people go running without their pants, don't you?
Yes, so do
anyway, I. He was found a few hours later because he wasn't all that hard to spot, guy without pants, and finally made it to the hospital. By the way, it is cold in Wisconsin this time of year.
Yes.
And the idiot had to be treated for frostbite injuries.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's a heck of a place to get frostbite.
Yeah. You know, when you get frostbite in those low-lying regions.
Yeah. I know. If that happened to me,
yeah.
Oh, I'd be peeved.
I understand.
And, you know, when I get peeved.
What, Steve?
And I'm angry over the Yankees winning the World Series.
Yes.
You know what I do?
What do you do, Steve?
I take keyboard in hand and I write a 2-minute tirade.
Yes.
And today I want to tell you about the Yankees a little bit, if I could, because I'm peeved.
Okay.
Okay, Peter, as I mentioned, you know, it's not so much the Yankees I want to take a shot at tonight, even though I hate the Yankees. I want to take a shot at John Sterling, the New York Yankees broadcaster. Baseball fans love the game and the voices of the game. There have been some greats down through the years, and I've had a chance to meet some of these folks, people like Harry Kellis, long Philadelphia Phillies broadcaster, play-by-play guy for many, 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 many years. He would say in that deep, deep voice, "It's out of here," whenever a home run was hit. Oh, it sounded great. Then there was longtime Pirates broadcaster Bob Prince. He was also with the Astros, but primarily known as the Pittsburgh Pirates broadcaster. "Kiss it goodbye" was what he used to say for a home run. Sometimes he'd mix it up with "Open the window, Aunt Minnie, here it comes." Occasionally you'd hear the sound effect of glass breaking after he said that, and well, let's face it, Prince would add, "Too late, Minnie," because it smashed through the window. There's Florida Marlins broadcaster and former original Montreal Expos radio guy, Dave Van Horn, with his signature home run call, "Up, up, and away!" Then there was Harry Carey with, "Holy cow!" and also, "It might be, it could be, it is!" as the Northsiders from Chi-Town knocked on heaven's door but haven't made it to beyond the pearly gates for more than a century. Here in St. Louis, there was a legendary guy, name of Jack Buck, with his signature call, "That's a winner," whenever he signed off following a Cardinals victory. He got to say that a lot over the years. Pretty fun for Cardinal fans. My favorite call comes from the Brooklyn and L.A. Dodgers baseball god, Vin Scully. When Hank Aaron hit number 715 to pass the Babe, he told listeners the ball was going and gone. He then said nothing for the next 10 minutes as the crowd in Atlanta went wild. His logic was, if anybody tuned in and heard the crowd going nuts, they'd know what had happened. If they weren't baseball fans, well, they wouldn't be tuning in the first place. Today, we're cursed with John Sterling of the New York Yankees with his idiotic signature call of, "The Yankees win! Yankees win!" Full disclosure, as mentioned previously, I hate the Yankees. But I can appreciate Yankee broadcasters, like the late Phil Rizzuto. But John Sterling can never be placed in the same hall of honor as people like Vin and Phil and Bob and Jack and Dave and the two Harrys. They had something to offer. This guy, he just sounds like an idiot.
Hear, hear. You're not going to get any disagreement from me. I'll toss in his other call that drives me nuts. It's an A-bomb from A-Rod. Oh, God.
I can't stand him. I can't stand... I just get so upset when I think of... I call him the idiot. No, take that back. I call him the idiot.
There you go. Steve.
I can't help it. I'm sorry.
Steve, always a pleasure to have you on the program. People, by the way.
The pleasure was all yours, Peter.
I know. People can check out your work. They can go to the website, which is MissouriNet.com, www.MissouriNet.com, where you can find all of Steve's work, including the blog that he writes for the MissouriNet Network.
Absolutely.
In the meantime, I know you're busy, so just say those three magic words.
Hit the theme!
You're listening to The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@peteranthonyholder.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook.
And we're almost done with this edition of The Stuff File program. We have enough time for a couple of Stuff File stories, including the idiot of the day. Well, more proof that multitasking while driving is never a good idea. A truck driver in Borås, Sweden, crashed his 18-wheeler, and while fortunately not seriously hurt, he was pinned, immobile, in the wreckage until rescuers could get him out. Nobody knows for sure, but police have an idea what caused the accident. When rescuers first saw him, they noted that the trapped driver's genitals were exposed and that his hand was clasped in his genital area. What could have caused the crash? What? In any case, that story, as dumb as it may sound, doesn't constitute the idiot of the day. This next story does.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
To Tampa we go. Florida police say a man arrested for repeatedly calling 911 looking for sex claimed it was the only number he could dial after running out of cell phone minutes. Tampa police said 29-year-old Joshua Basso made sexual comments to the 911 dispatcher and asked if he could come to her house. Investigators say she hung up, but he called back four more times. He was arrested about 15 minutes later at his home late Wednesday and charged with making a false 911 call. Basso reportedly told officers he didn't think he would get into trouble for calling 911. Tampa jail records show Basso was being held without bond. He's listed as unemployed with arrests for theft and other crimes dating back to 2001. Why would someone call 911 asking for sex not think that they would get into trouble for doing that? There's only one reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Coming up on our next show, William Gladstone, author of The 12, a novel set in the year 2012, Can anyone say doomsday? Also, Tom Reuter, creator of the official shotgun rules. Who gets the front seat? The website, peteranthonyholder.com, where you'll find information and links on our guests by going to the What's On page. Just look for the corresponding date and program number, in this case, 0013. Email me at peter@peteranthonyholder.com. You could also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/paholder and Twitter at twitter.com/paholder. We hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com. Until next time, I'm Peter Anthony Holder. Bye-bye.
You've experienced another edition of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Now, doesn't that make you feel all warm and fuzzy? Like watching puppies and kittens frolicking in a field of daisies. Like the smells coming from Grandma's kitchen. Like the hallucinogenics you took in the 60s and I'm taking right now. Hello, cartoon birdies. Perhaps I said too much. Anyway, you know what I mean. Let the glow wash over you and enjoy. Peace out.